introduce this talk about the danger of software patents, I should start by explaining that this talk is not about, quote, intellectual property, unquote, because there's no such subject. Anyone who tries to talk to you about, quote, intellectual property, unquote, is probably either trying to snow you or to lead you to shallow thinking. If somebody says you're infringing, quote, intellectual property, unquote, then he's trying to intimidate you and threaten you without even telling you what the threat is about. That term, quote, intellectual property, unquote, is a catch-all for various disparate areas of law that have nothing in common, except that they're something that can be bought and sold. So people use that term to get you to focus on that meager bit of commonality and ignore all the individual issues of these different areas of law, which is where all the real public issues lie. In other words, ignore the important questions and focus on something so abstract that you can't even see the questions. For instance, they generalize together copyrights and patents and trademarks, and no two of them have anything in common. The details of the laws are completely different. You might be led to suppose that there is some kind of principle of, quote, intellectual property, unquote, which these laws represent. That's not true. They evolved independently for different reasons. They literally have nothing in common. And yet, I have to repeat this over and over because I'm sure many of you find that incredible. You've been brainwashed by a misleading, overgeneral term. When people try to think about copyrights and patents together, the only possible answers are simplistic overgeneralizations. So you have to choose between which simplistic overgeneralization you're going to believe in. And none of them make any sense. So I have no opinions about, quote, intellectual property, unquote. I have opinions about copyright, which I described in taking an hour yesterday, and I have very different views about patents, which I'm going to talk about today. In order to understand patents or copyrights, the first thing you must do is recognize that they are unrelated to each other and have nothing in common, and that anything you learn about one of them is surely not true of the other. If you know something about copyright, you should guess that patents are different. Let me say a little bit about patents in general. A patent covers an idea, always. A patent is a monopoly, an artificially created monopoly on using an idea. The idea could be whatever might be described in words in a field where patents are allowed. Patents are issued by a patent office in response to an application. So someone applies for a patent, and then the patent office may or may not issue a patent. Supposedly, they judge by the standard of whether the idea is new, useful, and unobvious. But practically speaking, the criterion is unobvious to somebody with an IQ of 80. Then, once the patent is issued, everyone involved in the patent system describes this idea as an invention and implies that it must have been an act of genius to think of it. Occasionally that was true, often it was not. Patents last for 20 years, which in some fields may not be that long if progress is not going rapidly. But in the field of software, well, 20 years ago, the IBM PC was still new. So you can imagine what it would be like if we were limited to software as it was 20 years ago. And finally, a patent is a complete monopoly on the use of the idea. Even if you can prove that you thought of the idea yourself, that's no defense. It's considered irrelevant. Everything I have just told you would not be true of copyright law. Every one of the things I've just said is one of the differences between patents and copyrights. So you can see they are totally different systems of law. They also cover completely different kinds of things. Copyrights do not cover any idea. That's an explicit part of copyright law, that ideas are not covered by copyright. But patents cover only ideas. The Economist once compared the patent system to a time-consuming lottery. If you've seen the advertisements for lotteries, they always focus on what it's like to win. They never talk about the more likely possibility of losing. The reason for this is clear. They want to bias your thinking, distort it, prevent you from being rational. Most descriptions of the patent system focus on the possibility that you might be a patent holder. They ask you to see the system from the point of view of somebody who gets a patent and then can walk down the street and point it at people and say, "Give me your money." The reason is that these descriptions usually come from people with a vested interest in the patent system. For instance, the bureaucrats in charge of it. They have an interest in having more patents in more areas because that means that their bureaucracy is more important in everyone's life. The other people who will tell you about the patent system are typically patent lawyers, essentially mercenaries who have a vested interest in having more wars because that means more employment for them. When you say this to a patent lawyer, you'll typically get a somewhat disingenuous response. The lawyer will typically say, "Oh, I'm not necessarily in favor of patents. I work for defendants too," which is surely true, but misleading, because although the lawyer might be willing to work for either side in a dispute, the lawyer still wants to have many disputes about patents, which means the lawyer has a vested interest in having patents and in having more of them. So both of these kinds of patent professionals will describe the system in a way that encourages distorted thinking. To counteract the bias of what they say, I'm going to describe what the patent system is like for a person who might be in danger from it, for a person who wants to develop software. So, imagine that you are a programmer and you want to develop a program and you know that there are software patents. Oh, Des, someone else is making a video. What are the things you have to do? Well, the first thing you'd want to do is find out which patents might interfere with your project. This is impossible because patent applications are kept secret. Now, in some countries, they're published after 18 months, but that's still plenty of time. So, in fact, a patent could be issued tomorrow or next year, and there's no way you can find out about it now. There's simply nothing you can do to protect yourself. This is not just a theoretical possibility. It really happens. In 1984, someone wrote a data compression program called Compress. And at the time, this was patent-free. But then in 1985, a patent was issued on the LZW compression algorithm used in Compress. And at that point, anyone distributing this program was in danger of getting sued. Even anyone running the program was in danger of getting sued. It took a few years before companies started getting threatened. And then we started looking at developing a safe replacement for Compress. Someone said, contacted us and said he had an algorithm we could use and he'd implemented it. He actually had a program for us. When it was a week or two away from being released, I happened to see the New York Times on a day that it happened to have its weekly patent column. This was quite rare. It happened maybe once a year. And it said that somebody had got a patent on a, quote, new method of data compression, unquote. So I said, we better check this patent. And it covered the program we were about to release. That program died before it was born. Anyway, we later went on to find another algorithm and we released the program that is now known as GZIP. So, you can't find out about the patents that might get issued in the future that you might get sued for. But you can, at least in theory, find out about the already issued patents because they're published by the Patent Office. You could read them all if you didn't want to do anything else because tens of thousands are issued every year of software patents every year in the U.S., to take an example of a country that allows software patents. So you'd be kept very, very busy if you tried to find out about them. So you would try to search for the ones that are relevant. You might think that this is easy to do, given today's computer technology. It's not always so easy or reliable. For instance, some years ago, there was a patent on natural order recalculation in spreadsheets. What does natural order recalculation mean? It means if you change a cell, the cells that depend on it get recalculated, and then the cells that depend on them get recalculated, and it doesn't matter where they are located in your grid, they get recalculated in the right order so that they're all consistent when it's done. The early spreadsheets did all their recalculation top down. So if a cell depended on something below, you might have to recalculate several times to get the change to propagate upwards. But with natural order recalculation, it doesn't matter where the cells are located. Everything gets updated after the things it depends on. This is actually a very simple algorithm that can be programmed in probably 20 lines of code. It's called topological sorting, and I found the first description of it in the literature from 1963. The patents on this technique would have been very hard to find. In fact, when I showed it to someone, he said, I think you sent me the wrong patent. So I double-checked, and yes, it was the right patent. Because you see, this patent doesn't say anything about spreadsheets. It doesn't mention the term natural order recalculation. It doesn't mention the name topological sort either. Its title is A Method for Compiling Formulas into Object Code. But notwithstanding that peculiar title, what it covers is a topological sort algorithm in about 70 different ways you could do it. The patent holders were demanding 5% of the gross sales of every spreadsheet sold in the U.S. So, you can't find all the relevant patents, but you can find some of them. At that point, you have to figure out what they mean. That's not easy because patents are written in tortuous legal language, which is almost completely impossible to understand. The Australian government did a study of patents in the 1980s, considering what Australia should do with its patent system. The conclusion was that if not for international pressure, Australia should abolish its patent system, but because there was international pressure, Australia should make patents harder to get, narrower in scope, and make them not last as long. One of the things it cited was that engineers generally don't read patents to try to learn anything because it's too hard. They quoted an engineer as saying, "I can't recognize my own inventions in patentees." And I've seen personally evidence that this is true. In the 1980s, Paul Heckel obtained a couple of patents on ideas that I simply cannot describe. I spent a long time looking at the claims of those patents, trying to formulate some simple description of what they cover. I never could. And he wasn't really sure either, because when he first saw HyperCard, he didn't think that was the same as his idea. Certainly wasn't like his program. But then his lawyer said that the way the claims were written, they did cover HyperCard. And therefore, he sued Apple. Or I don't know actually whether he got as far as actually filing suit or just threatened them. In any case, once I was giving this speech, and he was in the audience, and at this point, he stood up and said, "That's not true. I just didn't know the scope of my protection." And I said, "Yes, that's what I said." And he sat down again. So, in fact, to get any idea what these patents mean, you're going to have to talk with a lawyer and spend a lot of time talking with a lawyer. It's going to cost a lot of money. And at the end of the discussion, the lawyer will report to you that if you do something in this area, you're almost certainly going to lose. If you do something in this area, there's a substantial chance that you'll lose. And if you really want to be safe, you better stay out of this area. And there is a sizable element of chance in the outcome of any lawsuit. So, at this point, now that you have a sort of a predictable situation for doing business, what can you do? There are three options, any one of which might or might not be applicable in any given situation. One option is to avoid the patent. Another is to license the patent. And the third one is to challenge its validity in court. First, to avoid the patent. That means don't use the idea that's patented. Well, this may be easy or hard. It may be painless or it may be intolerable, depending on what the idea is and how broad it is. Sometimes what the patent covers is an algorithm. And in that case, maybe you just use another algorithm and get the same job done. Or maybe there is no other algorithm. Maybe there's only one algorithm known to produce precisely the result you need. For instance, consider the LZW compression algorithm. We found another compression algorithm and we released another program for data compression. For users who wanted a way to compress data, that was perfectly good. Our compression program became a de facto standard. Compress was forgotten. But some people use data compression for other reasons. Consider the GIF image format. That uses LZW compression also. The GIF format was developed by CompuServe in the 1980s and became a de facto standard on the internet. In fact, I'm pretty sure that the patent holders deliberately waited to give this standard a chance, to give this format a chance to become standard, so that everyone would have so much invested in it that they'd be helpless once the attacks and threats started. So, people, of course, took the GZIP algorithm and made an image format using that. It's called PING, for Pings Not GIF. And they said to people, "Switch to this, you'll be safe." And what happened? The people using images said, we're not going to switch because the software that people use doesn't support PING. And the software developers said, "Well, we don't see any hurry about supporting PING because we can't stop supporting GIF. All the users are still using GIF." It was a situation where neither side could move without the other side. It's very hard to change a de facto standard. And when that de facto standard is covered by a patent, it doesn't do any good at all to find a better alternative. Just this year, someone popped up and said he has a patent covering JPEG. JPEG is the other popular image format on the net. So they're both covered by patents in the U.S. Now, our lawyer told us that the patent on JPEG seems very weak and that we shouldn't worry about it at this point. But they are suing some companies that distributed JPEGs or JPEG software. And it's not just the software developers that can get sued. A number of companies were threatened because they have GIFs on their websites, and they didn't know for certain if those GIFs were produced with properly patent-licensed software or not. So they were told that they might be infringing and they should pay money to get let off the hook. Users as well can be sued. Now, these two standards are both covered by one thing is patented for each one. But that's not quite true for JPEG, so for GIF, because the LZW algorithm has been patented twice in the U.S. There are actually two patents for the same idea. What this shows is that the U.S. Patent Office can't even tell what's patented. There are reasons for that, by the way, but I'll talk about that later. And this isn't the only such case. Remember that program that we were going to release and a patent came out just a week before? Well, that algorithm has been patented twice, too. So apparently this is not so rare, even. But that's just, you know, here we're talking about one or two patents. That's nothing. The MPEG-4 standard is covered by 39 different U.S. patents. It took longer to work out a way for anyone to license these patents than it took to design the standard. Sometimes what's patented is a feature. Then you can avoid the patent by taking out that feature. Sometimes that's painless. Sometimes it's a disaster. At one point, the users of the word processor Xyrite got a downgrade in the mail. It turns out that someone had got a patent on a feature used in Xyrite. They tried negotiating with him to get a patent license, and they found that he was impossible to negotiate with. So they took the feature out instead, and they sent the users a downgrade. They wrote to me about it because they knew I had implemented a very similar feature in the Emacs editor years before. In fact, this was interesting because it showed me I have had at least one patentable idea in my life. I know it's patentable because somebody else patented it afterwards. So it could be that my work was prior art for this patent, but they decided not to go to the trouble of fighting it in court. Well, if you take out one feature, maybe the users will still like your program. But as you start taking out more and more different features that users want, eventually it's going to be hard to have a program that users will use. They'll think this is inferior. I can't do this. I can't do that. I expect these things to be here. And in some cases, a patent is so broad that you can't do anything at all. For instance, the entire field of public key encryption was essentially off limits to almost everyone for more than a decade while people were trying to implement it because of a very broad patent. Now, you'll find people who make the assumption that it's only the stupid trivial patents that are harmful, but the public key encryption patent covered an idea that was brilliant. And yet that patent was tremendously harmful to society. So that is the option of trying to avoid the patent. There's also the option of trying to get a license to use the patent. It should be noted that the patent holder doesn't have to offer you a license. The patent holder can just say, I'm shutting you down. And this sometimes happens. I once heard from, the League for Programming Freedom heard from someone whose family business was making computerized casino games. And they used computers at that point. Then he got threatened by a patent holder who said, "We don't want any competitors. We're just going to shut you down." Well, this patent covered a system for playing games where there was more than one computer on a network, and each computer could support more than one different game and could support multiple instances of the game at the same time. Patent offices tend to think that doing something more than once is an invention. They don't realize it's a basic principle of computer science to abstract things, and that anything you can do once, you could do multiple times. Anything that you can have one of, you can have many of. Anything which you could have one of, you could have multiple variants of, side by side. This is the principle known as making a subroutine and calling it multiple times, making subclasses that are somewhat different from the parent class. These things are always obvious in programming, in software design. But patent offices think that they're extremely unobvious. Well, eventually, he really just had to shut down. He was out of business. He couldn't afford to fight them in court, even though one might question whether this patented idea was really unobvious. Sometimes you can get a patent license, but it costs you a painful amount. For the natural order recalculation patent, the patent holder was demanding 5% of the gross sales of every spreadsheet. And I was told that was the cheap pre-lawsuit price, that after a lawsuit, they would have demanded more. Now, maybe you can afford to license one patent that way, but what if your program uses 20 different patented ideas and each one wants 5%? What if you use 21 different patented ideas? Well, people in business have told me that, practically speaking, two or three such patent licenses would make your company probably fail. But there are companies for whom licensing patents is a very successful method. Those are the mega corporations. IBM, for instance. IBM wrote an article in its own magazine, Think Magazine, issue number 5, 1990, about IBM's patent portfolio. And IBM said that it got two kinds of benefit from its 9,000 active U.S. patents. One kind of benefit was collecting royalties. But the other benefit, which it said was an order of magnitude greater, was getting access to things others had patented through cross-licensing. Basically, the large companies all have lots of patents, and they cross-license, meaning that all of them can use all of these ideas. IBM, with its many patents, can make almost everyone cross-license, almost everyone who's really making any products or services. And when they say that this benefit is 10 times the benefit of the royalties they collect, what does that really mean? The patent system is a time-consuming lottery because most patents never bring in any money to their owners. So if you're getting a few patents, what happens to you as a result is tremendously variable. But IBM is so big that it measures the average behavior of the patent system. And what IBM sees is that, and the other thing to realize is, the benefit IBM gets by getting, without paying any money, licenses for most other patents is that they avoid the harm that the patent system would have done to them. So the harm that the patent system would have done to them is more than 10 times the benefit they would have got. This is if they couldn't cross-license. But in fact, they do cross-license, so that harm doesn't happen. they only get the benefit. They don't get the harm. They avoid the harm through cross-licensing. But nonetheless, it's useful for us to get this measurement on the average of how big that harm would have been if not for cross-licensing. And what we see is it's 10 times the good. Now, there is a widespread myth that patents, quote, protect, unquote, the, quote, small inventor, unquote. It's the myth of the starving genius, the brilliant designer of, you fill in the blank, who has spent years living in an attic designing a better way to make, you fill in the blank, and now it's working, he wants to set up a company and make these things, except the big companies will start competing with him and they'll take all the business away from him and his company will certainly fail and he'll starve. That's literally the word that they like to use. It's an exaggeration. Well, the scenario was unrealistic. For one thing, ideas in high-tech fields don't generally develop in a vacuum. People come up with ideas because they're working in the field, developing things, and talking with other people. And another thing is, a small company doesn't necessarily go out of business because it has a big competitor. Big companies are better at some things. Small companies are better at some things. If a person with a small company is smart, he'll focus on the things where small companies and their agility is advantageous. And finally, anyone who's that smart in a high-tech field can get a job. So he's not going to starve in any case. But the crucial question is, what do we make of it when the myth continues and says he won't fail if he gets a patent, because the patent will, quote, protect him. He can say, IBM, you can't compete with me because I've got this patent. So there. What really happens is that IBM says, oh, you have a patent. Well, we have this patent and this one and this one and this one and this one and this one, which various parts of your product infringe. And if you think you can defeat those in court, well, we'll just look for some more. So cross-license with us. And then this brilliant small inventor cross-licenses with IBM, and then he doesn't have to fear getting sued by IBM. But now IBM is allowed to compete with him. The patent didn't protect him after all. That's the whole point. Patents don't protect you from the mega corporations. The idea that patents will, quote, protect, unquote, these small inventors from mega corporations is just a myth in fields like software. Now, there's another myth about the patent system. Well, actually, that belongs at a later point in the talk. So, cross-licensing works pretty well for IBM, but even IBM can't make every patent holder cross-license, because some patent holders don't make any products. All they make are lawsuits and threats. These patent parasites can't be made to cross-license. You see, lawyers understand very well what a pain in the neck the patent system is, because they have not allowed patenting of techniques of litigation. So if a company only makes lawsuits, they're not ever going to infringe any patents. Even IBM can't make them cross-license. So they squeeze money out of everybody, and IBM just pays it and figures that it's, well, that they're making so much that they can afford to lose some. So that is the possibility of licensing a patent. The third possibility is to challenge its validity in court. The crucial thing to recognize here is that whether there is a case to do that depends on a large number of historical accidents. It depends whether the idea was published in the appropriate fashion a sufficient time before the patent application, and it depends on whether that publication survived and can be found so as to present it as evidence. It also depends on precisely how close the thing that's described in that publication is to what you want to do today. And the fact is that what we want to do with software is constantly changing because the context is changing. In the 1980s, people often developed client-server solutions, a special-purpose application talking through a specially designed network protocol to a special server program. Today, to do the same job, people will often develop a web-based interface. They put something into a web server so that you can use a web browser to do this job. Well, the requirements of making it web-based are somewhat different, which means that some details are going to have to be different, which means that even if it's basically the same thing people did in the 80s, today someone could patent the details necessary to do it using the web. So as long as changes in the context keep churning things around, the things you want to do today will always be patented, even if basically the same thing was published, publicly described in the 1980s. Another problem with finding any relevant prior art is that once you present it, the court's going to ask, is this idea obvious given that prior art as a starting point? And so the question is, what is their criterion for obvious? If they use the criterion of obvious to someone with an IQ of 80, then each point of prior art is going to cover no territory. It's going to be like American soldiers in Vietnam, covering, you know, controlling only the ground they stand on. It will hardly matter. So you find some points of prior art. They'll just adjust the boundaries of the patent to go around them. This is why you should not tell the patent office the prior art. It's better if they issue a patent that does intersect with the prior art. It'll give you at least some way of trying to scare off that patent holder later. If the patent holder finds out about this prior art from the patent office, the patent holder will be able to rig the boundaries of the patent so that it covers what people want to do today but avoids the prior art. And then you're going to be really in trouble. So it's better to save up the prior art and pass it to the defendant. The other problem with challenging the validity of the patent is that it's extremely expensive. There was a patent lawsuit against Qualcomm. I think that was about a software patent, although my memory is hazy now. But I probably wouldn't have thought about it at all if it hadn't been a software patent. Anyway, I do remember that they lost and they had to pay $13 million, and more than half of it went to the lawyers on both sides. So it's extremely expensive, and this means that even a putatively invalid software patent is a very dangerous weapon to be attacked with. People will often dismiss the possibility of invalid patents being issued, saying, well, they'll be cleared up by the courts. But that's very little comfort for you if you aren't rich enough to go to court. That's a special concern to us in the free software community, because the thing that makes free software possible, that makes it possible for us to develop such a broad range of free software, is the fact that it doesn't take money. We don't need any capital to develop software. That's not true for other fields like automobiles. But in software, it's true. Well, you can develop the software without capital, but you can't fight a patent suit without capital. So those are the three possibilities. Each time you see somebody pointing a patent in your direction, these three possibilities may be available. Each one of them, independently, may or may not be available. So sometimes they're all available. Sometimes just one of them is available. And sometimes none of them is available and your project is dead. So software patents make developing software like crossing a minefield. At each step, at each design decision, chances are you're not going to step on a patent. But considering how many design decisions you have to make to get to the end of the design, it becomes very dangerous indeed. At any moment, you might step on a patent which would blow up and destroy your whole project. Now, people sometimes ask me, or say, other fields have dealt with patents for a long time. Why should software be any different? This is a silly question. It's like saying, other people have AIDS, why shouldn't you? As if we had a duty to suffer with a difficult system. But there is a good question related to that, namely, is there a difference between software and other fields? Is there a reason why the policy should be different in different fields? How do we decide the right policy for any field? Now, there's very little evidence that patents benefit society in any field. There is very little empirical evidence about the effects of having patents in high-tech fields. According to Professor Merges, who studies the effects of patent systems, one of the few pieces of evidence we have is from the software field, which until 1982, even in the US, was unaffected by patents, and the software field was making tremendous progress. So there's some evidence that patents are not necessary, for whatever it's worth. It's hard to run two alternative worlds and see, you know, one with software patents and one without, and see which world gives more progress. But we can see differences between different fields. They differ in, among other things, how patents relate to products. We have a naive idea of the patent system where for each product there is one patent. So if you develop a new product, the only one who could get a patent on it is you. You don't have to worry that somebody else has already patented your new product. That is what it would be if the patent covered the whole design of a product. And I think in the 1800s, that was often true. And it's still more true in some fields than in others. For instance, in pharmaceuticals, typically the whole chemical formula of a drug is patented. So if you develop a new drug, it's not patented already by someone else. I'm told that this is starting to change even in pharmaceuticals. In any case, pharmaceuticals are at one extreme. Software is at the other extreme. If you look at a word processor today, you will see hundreds of features. Any one of them might be patented. Multiple aspects of one feature might be patented. A combination of features might be patented as a combination. Algorithms that you use to implement these features might be patented. Standards that you must implement may be patented. JPEG was an official standard. A standards body had issued it as a standard. A few months ago, they withdrew the standard officially because they have a rule that their standards must be freely implementable by everyone. And since the patent holder of this patent that covers one part of JPEG refused to allow royalty-free use, they said, we can no longer endorsed this as a standard. They withdrew it. Unfortunately, that doesn't enable everybody to stop using JPEGs and switch to anything else. It was a gesture that may count for something if you learn from it and if you fight against software patents. But other than that, it doesn't do any good. So in this situation where there are many patents for one product, the patent system tends to tie up development. But why is it that software packages have more ideas in them? The reason is that they're just more complicated. And why is it that software packages are more complicated? Because software is fundamentally easier than physical engineering. This is because we are building constructs out of idealized mathematical elements, which do exactly what they're defined to do. We don't just have models, we have definitions. In physical engineering, there are models, and you can try to use these models to predict what something will do. And then the actual matter will do what it does. And if it doesn't agree with your model, too bad. Because the model is not a definition, it's just a theory. But for programming constructs, we have definitions. They do what they are defined to do. There are so many complications of building physical systems that we don't have to worry about in my field. For instance, when I put an if statement inside of a while loop, I don't have to worry if the if statement's drawing its power through the while statement will cause a sufficient voltage drop that the if statement won't work. I don't have to worry whether the loop will run at the wrong frequency so that it will induce a current in some other part of the program and cause wrong values. We don't have to worry whether corrosive substances will get in between the if statement and the while statement and eventually cause the data not to get through. We don't have to worry if the loop will run at the wrong frequency and the if statement will vibrate and wear away part of the while statement. We don't have to worry whether if it runs too often, the if statement will dissipate so much heat that it burns out. We don't have to worry whether, when we examine the value of a variable, whether we're reading the same variable too many times and exceeding the fan-out limit. We don't have to worry whether we refer to a value too soon after it's computed and the capacitance is too high and the value's not right yet. We don't have to worry how we're going to replace that if statement if it does crack. And we don't have to worry about the physical order of assembly of all the millions of statements in this program. In fact, when you're producing physical products, you have to design not only the product itself, but the factory to produce them, which can be much harder than designing the product itself. You have to design the product so that the pieces can be assembled. We don't have to do that. We write the program, and the design is the product. And if we want to mass produce copies, we just say copy, 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 copy. We don't have to make a factory for each program. We said we make a master disk and we send that to somebody and say, make 10,000 of these. So it's tremendously easier. But the intelligence of people in the software field, I presume, is the same range, of course, as in any other field. So when we are faced with a fundamentally easier kind of job, what do? We push it further. You know, if systems the same size as what they do are very easy, we make systems 10 times as big. Then it gets hard. If you've heard people talking, you may have heard people talking about how hard software is to design. They're making a different comparison. They're talking about the very large systems that we actually make. Yeah, you make it big enough and it gets hard. That's what sets the limit on how big systems can be. to have a software system with a million lines is nothing unusual. A few people can do that in a few years. To have a mechanical design or electrical design of a system with 10 million different parts, sorry, a million different parts, that's unheard of. There's never been such a project, I believe. I don't know, I guess maybe some chips are getting to that point, but those are mega projects that only a few companies can make. So it's tremendously easier in software, so we make the systems bigger. But that means more different ideas in them, more different points of vulnerability for one product. In other words, this is why software products relate to patents in a different way from the way chemical or mechanical or electrical products relate to patents. And well, actually, I take back what I said. Those chips that may have millions of components in them, that's a large number of repeating identical subunits. The number of different parts of the design is much smaller. But in a program, of course, we wouldn't have these repeating identical subunits. We'd replace them with a subroutine. So, this is the fundamental reason why software is different from other fields, why patents are more harmful in software, and also the reason why, if they ever do any good, they do less good in the software field than in other fields. You see, in some fields, coming up with an idea and making it work is extremely hard, because you're dealing with the perversity of matter. But in software, there's not really such a thing usually as developing an idea. You have the idea. If you think it's useful, the thing to do is write the code. In other words, developing the product, developing the details of the program. So, and in fact, if people are working on developing software, they're going to have ideas. The ideas come as a byproduct of having people working in the field. So, to have a system intended to promote progress that rewards the ideas by obstructing development of software is actually counterproductive even in its own terms. It's likely to result in fewer ideas, because if it's harder to develop software safely, there may be fewer people to have the ideas as a byproduct. The ideas are not the limiting factor in the software field. The limiting factor, the hard part of the job, is writing those million lines of code and getting all the details correct so that it works reliably and does things that the users want. Practically speaking, I've been in the software field since before there were software patents. I've seen no sign that progress is faster now because of software patents. Before software patents, most software developers would publish the ideas, at least if they were worth publishing, and they typically kept the program itself secret, which, as you know, I disapprove of, but that's a different issue, not related to software patents. Today, they typically patent the ideas and keep the software secret. So, the result is that there's been no benefit. One of the supposed benefits of the patent system is to encourage people to publish the ideas, but they published them before software patents. The only difference now is that now we can't use them when they're published. Before, we could use them when they were published. When you're talking to somebody who doesn't understand programming very well, There's an analogy you can use to make it clear just why software patents are bad for software development. A program is in some ways like a symphony. They're both a long combination of many, many details, and the effect comes from getting all the details to fit together right. And yet they do also embody ideas. One program will embody many different ideas. One symphony also will embody many different musical ideas. But you can't just take the idea and drop it in canned form, because the notes you use to embody the idea in this symphony will be different from the notes that were used to embody it in some other symphony. You know, the idea you could state in words is the same, but how you embody it with notes depends on what else is going on around it in that symphony, the other ideas you want to use. So, imagine that in the 1700s, the governments of Europe had wanted to promote the progress of symphonic music, and so they had established a system of musical idea patents, so that any musical idea that could be stated in words could be patented. Then imagine that it's 1800 and you were Beethoven and you want to write a symphony. You're going to find it's harder to write a symphony that you won't get sued for than to write a symphony that sounds good. Being Beethoven, you would complain about this very vociferously. And the patent holders would say, "Oh, Beethoven, you're just jealous because we thought of these ideas before you. Why don't you go invent some of your own ideas and use them?" Which is a ridiculous thing to suggest. In fact, Beethoven had a lot of new ideas, as composers go. But he had to combine them with many old ideas, ideas that people were already accustomed to in music, in order to write recognizable music within a genre that people would listen to. Pierre Boulez said he would reinvent the language of music from zero. He tried, but hardly anyone listens. The fact is, no one is such a genius that she can reinvent music from zero and make anything any good. It can't be done that way. If you don't use the ideas people are already familiar with, you can't make music. It's the same with the software field. No one is such a genius that he can reinvent software from zero and do it in a completely different way. Even if you have some new ideas, you have to combine them with a lot of old ideas or already known ideas to make a program that will be useful. So when you talk to people in governments and elected and officials and appointed officials to explain how dangerous software patents are to software development, this is an analogy that will serve you very well. It seemed to work pretty well with members of the European Parliament last week, and I hope you'll make it work for you. You will find a couple of other foolish arguments being used in favor of software patents. One of them is that it's necessary to harmonize the laws of the various countries. Well, I don't know. In China, it's illegal to criticize the government. Should it be illegal here, too? Do you really want to harmonize with every bad law? I hope you'll be selective about which foreign laws you want to imitate. Another foolish argument is the U.S. is in the lead in information technology, and the U.S. has software patents, so software patents must be good. Well, the U.S. was in the lead in information technology in 1980 when it had no software patents. So there's really no reason to believe that they have helped. I would say, if anything, that Europe has tended to catch up since then, although I haven't really studied that question and I'm not an expert. That's just a sort of layman's impression at a glance. Another foolish argument that you'll encounter is that U.S. companies have an advantage if there are software patents in the U.S. It's just the opposite. U.S. companies are vulnerable because there are software patents in the U.S. You see, each country has its own patent system, and that patent system restricts activities done in that country. Anybody can own a U.S. software patent, anyone in the world, and then can sue us Americans with it. So we are vulnerable to everybody in the world because our country is foolish enough to have software patents. Meanwhile, if you manage to avoid software patents in Britain, then you will be safe. No one will be able to sue you at home. So the result will be British companies could sue American companies, but American companies could not sue British companies. And you would have this advantage until either Britain is stupid enough to imitate the U.S. or the U.S. is smart enough to get rid of software patents. Now, you may find some people saying that the proposed EU directive doesn't allow software patents. The criteria that they have proposed for what they call computer-implemented inventions is the criterion of technical effect. They say that if the invention has a technical effect, then it can be patented, otherwise it can't. And they would like you to believe that technical effect has a very clear meaning, that it would allow things like a system, a process for curing, it would allow a patent on a process for curing rubber where there's a computer involved in figuring out when the curing is done. But it would not, they say, allow patenting something like a data compression algorithm. But in fact, the European Patent Office seems to be perfectly ready to disregard or to twist, to stretch the meaning of that expression. You can't rely on that expression to mean any particular thing. So if they say that the directive will not allow software patents, say, if that's the intent, why don't you change the words so that we can be sure? Why take the risk that the EPO might stretch the meaning? The EPO has already shown its willingness to disregard its instructions. The EPO is issuing software patents now, even though the Munich Treaty says it shouldn't, and even though the governments of Europe voted against it a couple of years ago, against changing it. So it's not just a speculation in this case. You could always speculate that a patent office will try to twist the criteria to allow more kinds of patents. That makes them more important in everybody's life. They're a bureaucracy. If they are regulating every aspect of, every aspect of computer use for everyone, that makes them more important, and they can feel that they are doing more of a job that way. So of course they're going to try to interpret the criteria that way. But in the case of the EPO, we don't have to speculate. We can see they're already trying to do this. It's necessary to make the law completely clear. It should even have examples in it saying, these are examples of things that cannot be patented, and here's why. People who are studying this political process tell me that the UK Patent Office is, in fact, a pressure group pressuring Europe to adopt software patents. And that means it is extremely important for people here in the UK to talk to people at all relevant levels of the government to say that the Patent Office is doing something wrong, pushing for a very dangerous policy, something that would give mega corporations total control over software development, something. And by the way, the 100,000 and more U.S. software patents will be brought over here very quickly if Europe adopts software patents. In no time, you would find a very large number of them because the patent holders would simply file an application here and say, we have the U.S. patent, or, you know, dates from the same date, so you would be in awful trouble. So, at this point, I guess I should ask for questions. Oh, here's a microphone.
I have a program where I work for a software company, and we're suffering from exactly the problems you're talking about. And one of the things that struck me is that in order to defend ourselves against the possibility of somebody patenting in the future something that we're doing now, we ought to be publishing in great detail everything that we're doing so that we can prove that we have prior art.
Yes.
One way to do this would be to open source that software.
Let's not talk about open source.
Sorry.
Please.
One way to do this would be to release it as free software.
Yes.
Do you think that that would be a useful defense?
Well, again, it helps to a certain extent. But if someone has already applied for a patent, or if there already is a patent, then that won't help you. And that's often going to be true. You know, only sometimes are you going to be the first to do any one particular thing.
A lot of your criticisms of software patents seem to be based around the incompetence of patent officers.
Actually, no. That's a minor aspect of it. Some people who criticize the patent system focus totally on that, and it's true that patent offices are very incompetent. I've seen different people have made estimates ranging from 40% to much more of patents that are absurd coming out of the U.S. They may not really conflict. One was 40% of all patents in the U.S. Should be invalid, and the other was about just software patents, and he estimated, I think it was more than three quarters, he said, would not pass the Crystal City test, which meant if the patent examiner went outside to a newsstand and looked through the magazines, he or she would see that this is not new. But while the patent office issues many patents on ideas that are fairly trivial, some of the patents are for ideas that are non-trivial and workmanlike, and some of them are for brilliant ideas. Those are rare, of course. But all of these patents are harmful. There are people who talk about getting rid of the bad software patents. Well, what makes a software patent bad? A software patent is bad if it hampers software development, which means that all those that aren't irrelevant are bad. One thing to keep in mind is that a company with clout over a certain area of the market can make whatever they choose into a de facto standard. So they can find something obscure enough that they can patent it. You know, some idea that's different from what other people have done, patent it. Then they can design their data format or their protocol or whatever it's going to be to use that particular idea, not because that idea is better than the alternatives, but because that way nobody can compete with them. Then they can make it a de facto standard, but using their market clout. And then they've leveraged their clout into total control over some other market. Microsoft is doing this, but Microsoft isn't the first. There's a file format used by Windows Media Player, and some aspect of it is patented by Microsoft. I'm sure they could have designed the file format some other way, and it would have been just as good. But they found something they could patent, and then they arranged to use it, just so that they can stop anybody from competing with them. And then they use their clout to make that format be a standard, effectively a standard, and then society is screwed. Society is essentially manufacturing dangerous power and handing it out to whoever can fulfill certain criteria. I first saw this being practiced by Digital Equipment Corporation in the 1980s. They made a terminal controller that communicated using direct memory access to the main computer. And they patented a certain technique for laying out the buffers to transfer the data through. This was all implemented in software on both sides, so it was a software patented effect. And there was nothing particularly superior about that technique. It was just something that nobody had written about so that they could patent it. And then because they decided to use this, what technique the main computer would expect to use with the controllers, they thus arranged that nobody could make a plug-compatible terminal controller to talk to their computer. So by using their clout over one product, they got total control over another market.
There is no patent on software in Europe. If you have some brilliant idea which is already patented in the US, then why just do you not finish it and feature it from Europe?
Well, sometimes you can.
Put it to some FTP or...
Well, please let me answer. Because those details are not the point. The situation in Europe is complicated. The European Patent Office is issuing plenty of software patents whose validity under the treaty is questionable. Some countries are issuing patents following these European Patent Office patents, and some are not. So there may be, in fact, now a country in Europe where you can publish this software. And people are sometimes doing this. The question is Europe going to adopt software patents? The directorate in charge of this is the Internal Market Directorate. And the person at the head of that directorate doesn't understand anything about this and is in the hands of the big companies. So he has proposed a directive that is ambiguous enough that they can tell us that it won't allow software patents, but really it could be twisted to allow them. So the question is, are people in Europe going to prevent that? For now, yes, indeed, in some countries in Europe it's possible to publish these programs. Will it remain so?
Your first energy is legal. Why didn't you just boycott the US and publish it in the other countries?
Well, I'm in the US, and most of our users were in the US, and I figured that a program that you couldn't distribute in the US didn't really do the job. And that was especially true back then. Back then, there were some people in other countries contributing to free software, but contributing to GNU, but mostly it was in the US. That's maybe now it's mostly Europe, I'm not sure. But that was the reason. I wasn't prepared to give the US up as lost. I might do something different. You know, if Europe resists software patents, then we might have to say the US has fallen under a shadow and freedom will survive in Europe. And if not Europe, then maybe India or maybe Brazil.
On the issue of the European patents, software patents, I think part of it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is not so much a bad European law, but actually a bad global law. And I know you don't like the term intellectual property, but let me finish.
It's not true.
But you don't know what I'm saying, so I'm not sure.
Oh, I do. I heard what you said already, but continue.
I mean, The TRIPS agreement.
No. TRIPS doesn't require software patents. So the experts seem to agree on this, that TRIPS doesn't require it, and therefore it's not relevant. That's why I said, no, it's not a global law. It could have been, that would have been horrible, but fortunately it isn't. Now, TRIPS does have many horrible requirements for other areas of life. We fortunately escaped from that particular danger. By the way, I think we should change the name TRIPS. We should call it TRIPE, Trade-Related Impediments to Productive Endeavor. The first thing to do is organize, talk to each other, talk to the people leading the fight against software patents in Europe, find out from them about the details of the situation. Talk with Nick Hill over there, who knows some things about the situation. Maybe he'd like to give his email address. I don't know if you want to do that, but you can. Microphone.
My email address is nick@nickhill.co.uk.
So, by working together, by comparing methods, by talking about who you should talk to and then going to talk to them, by trying various different people to talk to, by sending various different people to talk to the same person, you may influence some people. Talk to organizations of small businesses. If they realized that they were threatened with a new form of bureaucracy restricting all computer use, they might be very upset. But they're not thinking about it. Talk to large businesses that are not in the computer field or the telecommunications field. These businesses use software. It's very important to them to be able to use software. So they're not likely to benefit very much from software patents, but they could be very badly hurt by software patents. Talk to their executives about this. Spread the word about what the effects might be. To some extent, we suffer from the fact that the mega corporations in the computer field have been allowed to speak with the voice of professional and business organizations. In many cases, there will be a business organization that claims to represent business generally, and it has a committee to decide what it should say about issues like these. And the members of the committee are lawyers that work for some mega corporations. So they adopt a policy that is good for them, and most of the members of the organization don't even know what's what. But they can take control back. This was done in a German organization of software developers. It came out with a position in favor of software patents that didn't represent what most of its members thought. So some more of the members got on that committee and they reversed the decision. And above all, push for delay. Time is on our side as understanding of what's bad about software patents spreads.
I fully agree with your early statement that the patent has become an idea. I wonder, therefore, if you would have comments about patents which cover, say, gene sequences.
Well, the idea of a patent on a naturally occurring gene sequence is sort of an absurdity because discoveries are not supposed to be patentable. There is an excuse that is used, at least in the U.S., to justify patents on naturally occurring gene sequences. They say, they say that although the genes exist in chromosomes in nature, a purified form of the gene is something new. I think that this is bullshit. It's an excuse to make handout monopolies on things. And I think it's absurd. Now, patents on artificially designed genes, maybe that's legitimate. I mean, I'm not an expert on fields other than software. I would hesitate to say that patents are harmful in other fields. In software, I believe I have enough basis to say that. I would rather leave the decisions about other fields up to people who know those fields better than I do. Now, patents in some other fields raise a different kind of issue. For instance, patents on pharmaceuticals, when they are applied to poor countries, are a matter of life and death. But this is purely because of their effect on the price of drugs. It's a very different issue from the one I've raised here. And patents on living organisms, when they're applied to plants and animals used in agriculture, threaten farmers' freedom to continue breeding their plants and animals as they've done for thousands of years. So these are two very important issues, but they're different. And then perhaps in the field of manufacturing automobiles, maybe there's no important issue. Maybe patents are okay in that field. I don't know whether they promote progress at all, but if only large companies have to worry about them, maybe it's harmless. Maybe it's not worth fussing about. By the way, there is mathematical modeling to show how patents can retard progress in a field where there is incremental innovation. You can find this in www.researchoninnovation.org/patents.pdf. It's rather mathematical. I was in too much of a hurry to study that mathematics, so I'll just take for granted that they didn't make a mistake. You can check it if you want. It would be a good thing, of course, for people to check it, but I'm getting too old for that kind of thing. For more information on the situation with regard to software patents in Europe, see the site www.ffii.org. I'll wait for the microphone. How about? I guess that might be okay. I mean, those are physical objects. They're not software. Yeah, well, he wants the mic back.
So what about it in terms of physical objects, the objects in virtual reality created by software?
Well, then it would be restricting software development. And all the things I said to explain why software is different from working with the physical world apply there. Making something that is physical and works in the physical world is much harder than making a pure image that does what you want it to do. You can make, if you're programming a virtual reality, you can make things do whatever you want them to do. You're not limited by the real characteristics of real matter. You don't have to worry about corrosion and noise and overheating and voltage drop and so on.
I don't know if this is going to be called, it's just a notion that I had, but could you possibly argue that some algorithms being products of mathematics are in fact discovered?
I don't know. You know, in the U.S., they found an excuse to ignore that. The Supreme Court actually said explicitly that mathematical algorithms are unpatentable. So they found an excuse. They say that they're not patenting the mathematical algorithm, they're patenting the use of it for a specific purpose. Patent systems are very good at reinterpreting any limits placed on them. So they have to be designed very carefully, looking essentially at the patent office as if it were a bull being tied down in the middle of a china shop, and you have to make very sure it doesn't get loose.
There's an outfit in Cambridge, England, Cambridge University research team, have developed a scheme or a method of allowing
horrible shame.
No. Wait for it. They patented it because they didn't want anybody else to patent the idea, and then actually declared that they're not going to charge license fees for it for the good of the public.
Well, in that case, I'd say they're not doing anything wrong. But it would be better if we didn't have software patents and we didn't have to do things like that. I should also point out that nominally it should be the case that to prevent someone else from patenting this, they don't have to get a patent, they just have to publish it. Now that it may not always work so reliably, I must admit. So maybe what they did was a good thing to do. It may even have been the right way to handle it. I'm very glad that they had the grace not to use the patent to restrict us, but unfortunately, not everyone is as good as they are.
By the way, according to the radio this afternoon, the space shuttle has 3 million parts.
3 million parts total? But are they 3 million different parts?
They didn't say.
Because you see, it has three main engines, and those are identical, they're the same subunit. So maybe they count maybe that three times in those parts. Anyway, you'll note that the space shuttle was a mega project. What did it cost? Billions of dollars? How many billions to develop? I've written programs with 3 million parts. So this just illustrates my point that a few people can develop a software package with as many parts as would be a mega project if it were a physical system.
All right, just want to ask about what's your reaction if someone or some organization used the popular software such as the new project C or compiler and glue it in one software and put a patent on it?
I would be horrified, but that the danger is, the point is that there's nothing I can do to stop this. I once spoke at a hearing conducted by the U.S. Patent Office. I brought a listing of the GNU-C compiler, and I asked them to tell me how many patents it infringes. And I thought this was just a gesture, but actually one of the people from the patent office actually said he was interested in taking the listing back and reading it. So I said, good, take it. It meant that we didn't have to recycle all that paper. That's good. But nobody knows, you see. No one can tell.
The argument that's often used in the pharmaceutical industry, which seems a little bit more plausible, is that if you've got a big research program, you've got a fund to develop something, that you need a patent to ensure the company can get a return on that investment. Could you say something sort of about that in the software area?
Well, it's clearly not true. You see, because in software, you don't spend the time developing an idea that might be patented. You spend the time writing the code. And in fact, they normally prevent anyone from copying that code anyway, and not with patents. Patents are irrelevant to that. So why stop somebody else from spending time writing another program, which is partly different and partly similar, and uses that idea together with various other ideas? There's no argument for it. In the case of pharmaceuticals, that argument could in some worlds be a valid argument, perhaps, and a valid argument for something. It might be a valid argument for having patents on pharmaceuticals in wealthy countries. But why have patents on them in poor countries, which only result in making the drugs too expensive for most people there so that they can't buy them? It has more effect of depriving people of the product than getting any money for the patent holders when it's applied to the poor countries. Now, in fact, from what I've heard, the commercial pharmaceutical research is not terribly useful for society. A study was done by the Office of Technology Assessment in the U.S. just before the Republicans got power and abolished it. And it was a study of where new pharmaceuticals came from and what they were good for. And they found that the pharmaceuticals that were developed by the drug companies usually were they were another way of dealing with some condition that a lot of people have in wealthy countries. And typically there were already drugs to handle those conditions, but say this company didn't own one, so they developed another one in order to compete. Well, this is not completely useless. You know, in some cases one drug works better for a certain person than another does. Having more alternatives is useful for something. But the drugs that really did something to advance medicine substantially normally came from government-sponsored research and not from these companies. So you have to ask, if this patent system is supporting research, is it supporting good research? Is it supporting research that's really effective? Oh, and another point. A study found that when studies are done of the effects of a drug, if they are funded by the drug company, they are less likely to report any harmful effects. Therefore, if we want good science to be done, we shouldn't have these studies funded by the drug companies at all. I don't understand. Complexity criterion of what? That would be irrelevant. Remember, I'm talking about the complexity of a product. It's a program is complex because it has a lot of parts, and these parts are embodying various different ideas. So it's not that the idea, you know, talking about the complexity of one algorithm or one feature is sort of missing the point. If there are software patents, they will create the minefield effect. Basically, if your criterion were adopted, it might reduce the number of software patents, and anything that reduced the number of software patents would reduce the problem somewhat. But, you know, if you could cause half the mines in a minefield to be deactivated, I guess that's a step forward. But why not simply clear the minefield? You know, why look for a way to have part of the problem when it's much easier just to have none of the problem? Right now, Europe is considering whether to have software patents at all. Why propose a halfway solution that might make half as many mines in the minefield? Why even consider it? What we want is not to have mines. Software patents don't do any good. If we have some somewhat restrictive criteria on them, then there might be fewer of them. It would cut down to some extent on the harm, but there would still be harm. What we really would need is to eliminate them, to avoid them completely. And that would be easier, you see. What you're proposing is harder. It would be a very hard thing to design a criterion like that. Why bother trying? Well, I've already explained why that's not advantageous to society in this field.
Well, if you do that and you allow patents above a certain level of protection, but after the patent holders actually publish a full-scale work,
it wouldn't make any difference, I assure you. It would make no difference at all if they published the source code. The point is, if the idea is restricted, if you can't use the idea in writing new programs, then it's causing a problem. Whether or not the patent holder public, first, the other thing is that the source code, just the idea that there is any the source code that goes with the patent is based on a misunderstanding. Because the point of a patent is that it covers an idea, and the idea is general. There isn't any one program that the patent is about. So I think, you know, many people assume there is. It's one of the misunderstandings of the patent system. People think that a software patent is about a program, which has source code. But it's not about any particular program. It's just about an idea. There is no source code for that idea. You could use that idea in a program, and that program would have source code. And I could use that same idea in a different program, which would have totally different source code. So there is no one source code that corresponds to the idea. Well, you could artificially say, to get the software patent, you must write some program and publish it as source code. Frankly, that would make no difference at all. It would be totally irrelevant. Because the problem of software patents is not, the problem of software patents is that these are ideas we can't use. What good is it to publish source code so I could more easily understand an idea that I'm not going to be able to use anyway? Why would I spend the time to study this idea? In fact, nobody does. It's not useful. Now, if you publish source code that I can use, that would be of some use, right? That would contribute to society. I publish source code that people can use. But publishing source code and saying, here is this nice thing and you can't use it, how's that going to help anybody?
You don't want to take it by the sound of any interim measures in reducing the harm of patents. Perhaps you have a strategy for actually pursuing the complete abolition of the U.S. software patent industry.
Well, how to convince the U.S. to change is a very hard problem. It's much easier in Europe. Europe is where the real issue is today, where software patents have become a political issue. In the U.S., they were never considered politically. There was never any public debate about whether to have software patents in the U.S. It was not a legislative or administrative decision. A court reinterpreted the law. But in Europe, it is a political decision. So forget the U.S. The U.S. we can't do anything about right now. But if the rest of the world resists software patents, maybe eventually the U.S. will wise up. What? Yes.
What about the compulsory license? Is it applicable to software patents also?
Well, if there were once you allow software patents, then TRIPS does make some requirements about what they can do. And they don't allow compulsory licenses very much. It gives very limited criteria for when there can be a compulsory license. So the answer is no. But the other thing is that compulsory licenses, if you're going to have a painless enough system of compulsory licenses, then you get more towards not having software patents. So why not do the easy thing and not have software patents? You see, any sort of compromise would be more complicated and more difficult than rejecting software patents in Europe entirely. So let's reject them entirely. You know, why? It's as if you've got a tremendously strong position that maybe you can defend, and then you start panicking and saying, oh, we're going to have to abandon this. Let's try fortifying some other position that's weaker. And why, that's dumb. Fight for the thing that other people are fighting for, because maybe we can win. We've got a chance at winning that. We've got a chance of winning it all. Why take a more difficult approach to win only partly?
suppose that the patents on software are not being produced in Europe, then do you think that the practice of basically featuring the ideas that are patented in the US from outside the United States would basically make the US patent world worth it after all?
No, you see, people in the U.S. would still be afraid to distribute that software, and that would really interfere with people. And people implementing software in the U.S., you know, companies in the U.S. that implement software couldn't just do that. And major companies in the U.S. using software could still be sued. You know, theoretically, anybody using the software in the U.S. could be sued, but practically speaking, individuals who are not particularly prominent are unlikely to be sued for patent infringement. Exactly. So for individuals could do it, but companies couldn't get away with it. And so, I answered your question, and as I said, it's a complicated situation. So the simple idea that having the program available in Europe would completely make the problem go away in the U.S. is not true. It would make things partly easier for people, yes. You know, to some extent, American individuals might feel it was safe to download this code, figuring they're not going to go to the trouble of suing me. And probably they're right. But that doesn't mean that the problem would be gone. It's more complicated than that. Actually, he hasn't asked yet, so let's give him a chance.
I'm just wondering about the following.
I can't understand what you're saying. Could you speak more clearly and loud?
I'm sorry. I'm just wondering about the following analysis of tech from China. If you look at the world of pharmaceuticals, on the one side, there are those people who have benefited. We know who they are, and they will benefit a great deal. On the other side, people who suffer like national health systems also know who they are. And they're all physically powerful, so you have a catalog of competition. However, on software, the large companies who might benefit know who they are, and the best interested. Unfortunately, people who suffer are much more diffused. They're powerful, and do not suffer in any particular way. And therefore, that creates a lot of kind of political problems in the mobile.
I couldn't hear the second half, the last half of that, but I think I understand enough to respond. You're right that part of the problem is that the people who will be harmed by software patents don't all know it, but some of them know it. Small companies and medium-sized companies in the computer field, they know it, and they are trying already to oppose software patents. But the situation, however, we should avoid making too much of a comparison between pharmaceuticals and software because, as I said, patents affect those two different fields very differently. The difference is much, much more than just whether the people who will be hurt know who they are. The whole phenomenon is different. Although it may be the same patent law, its effect on these two fields is totally different. I think it's time to call a halt to this, and so I hope that you will organize. We have a hard fight, but it's not lost yet, and we might still win if we fight hard. fighting against something happening.